Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for being with us tonight. With snow and ice covering so much of North America, it's a perfect night to curl up around the radio for a journey into the heart of darkness, human and otherwise. Tonight we gird our loins, button up the parka, check the compass, and embark on a radio expedition into the Great White North, Canada. As we all learned in school, the border between the U.S. and Canada is the longest between two countries in the world, and the longest that is not defended by military forces. At least that's the way it is at present. The world is changing before our eyes, as we all know, and who knows what the future holds. For now, anyway, that long, long border is manned by non-military personnel on both sides, police, immigration forces, and such. The two countries have so much in common, a deep and abiding friendship. We're important trade partners, friends, allies, partners in every sense of the word. What affects one affects the other. Tonight, we explore some other commonalities that are sometimes obscured or overlooked. In the second half of the program, we welcome, for the first time, a writer and investigator who's had a lifetime of what you'd call unusual experiences lumped into the general heading of paranormal, though we can't say for sure what the heck's been going on in the strange life of Dawn Hunter Clark. She's put it all into a book. Paranormal Canadian Tales is the title, and it covers a lot of territory, just like Canada itself. Dawn will be here 2 hours from now. First, though, a tragic and all too true story about mass murder in a place where you would not expect to hear such tales, the Arctic. More specifically, a set of wind-blown rocky islands in Hudson Bay, the Belcher Islands. They were, and still are, one of the most remote places on the planet. Hard to reach, isolated. It's a harsh, cold, Spartan existence and one of the last places to be penetrated by modern civilization. The inevitable interaction with us, with our technology, with our religion, with our laws, did to these particular indigenous people pretty much what it's done to indigenous peoples everywhere else. I don't have to spell it out for you. The story of the murders that we're going to talk about tonight is told by a world traveler, a world-class scribe, described by one reviewer as a master writer, naturalist, and adventurer. His name is Lawrence Millman, and I can tell you he knows his stuff. The story he weaves about the natives of the Belcher Islands and what happened to them is moving on several levels, perhaps most of all because of what it tells us about ourselves, about our planet, about our future. The book is called At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic, and it's powerful stuff. Lawrence Millman joins me momentarily. I had intended to get right to the program without covering any news tonight, any news of the day, that is, but just a couple of minutes ago, something came to my attention. Since our focus is on Canada tonight, I need to mention the events from earlier this evening. Five people were shot and killed at a mosque in Quebec City. Multiple shots fired inside this mosque during their evening prayers. The Prime Minister of Canada is calling it an act of terrorism. Apparently, what we know is two masked men burst in, started shooting. There were between 60 and 100 people inside at the time, including women and kids. These guys just started blasting, and then they tried to get away. Both are said to be in custody. We'll have further details as more is known. Don't know anything about motives here, but sure sounds like an act of terrorism. Our webmaster, Greg Bishop, is with me tonight. He and I have culled together our usual assortment of items and oddities, culled from various media sources over the last week or so. We put it together on the Coast website and call it Knapp's News. A few of the stories most definitely related to some of the themes we will explore tonight. One of those reports is about some archaeologists who've discovered new evidence in the form of butchered bones and the evidence suggests that humans arrived in North America, specifically in the Yukon, 24,000 years ago, which means that people were here much earlier than was generally assumed, way older than, say, the Clovis evidence or Kennewick Man or Spirit Cave Man, for that matter. It's a big deal in understanding our earliest ancestors here. Also, a story about murder in Iceland. It raises some of the same issues we're going to be covering tonight. There's a provocative piece from National Geographic about a new generation of world travelers, people getting out to see the world, other corners of the globe, which, you know, in so many ways is a good thing. But a lot of them are doing it so they can take selfies, which you'd have to say is kind of a mixed bag at best. Also, a great story about NASA scientists working on artificial intelligence, AI technology, that could someday be used in submersible craft, autonomous subs that would explore the oceans on extraterrestrial worlds. So it's like AI for ET from NASA. That story and more in NAPS News tonight on the Coast website. Maybe take a look at that a little bit later, because you'll want to hear what we're going to cover in the interview starting in just a moment. Our collective preoccupation with technology, with computer screens, is one of the central themes of the tale we're about to discuss. Folks, it's cold out there for so many of you. What you might call a three-dog night, or maybe a three-cat night if you prefer. Bring those critters inside, curl up together, slip into your fluffy cotton jammies and thick socks, toss a log on the fire, brew up a full pot of Joe, plop yourself down in the Barca lounger or on that comfy sofa, turn down the lights and turn up that radio, because we're ready to rumble in a moment. Lawrence Millman, Murder and Mayhem at the End of the World. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We've often speculated on this program about how we humans might react if aliens arrive from some other planet. And many of you think, yeah, I'd be ready to meet them. No problem. I can handle it. Even if they are much more advanced than us, in command of technology that for all intents and purposes is like magic, thousands of years beyond whatever we have. You know, more than a half a century ago, a study was conducted in secrecy for our government, and it gave sort of some bad news about that. It concluded that when two cultures collide, the one that's more advanced generally crushes the other one. And we've seen it ourselves. The European conquest of the Americas was pretty ugly. I mean, indigenous peoples were wiped out, shot, or killed by bullets or disease. Their worlds, for all intents and purposes, ended. One of the last untouched places in the world were these harsh scraps of rock and ice in the Hudson Bay, known as the Belcher Islands. The first outsider didn't arrive until 1916, and the place was so remote that even after that, the natives continued living their lives pretty much unchanged for several decades. But the handwriting was on the ice wall, so to speak, in big bloody letters. I think it would be an understatement to introduce Lawrence Millman as just a writer. He is a world traveler. He's been to and written about the deepest, darkest corners of our world, has a keen eye and a sharp wit and an appreciation for the natural world. He's written 15 books, the latest, At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic. And it's far more than a tale of true crime. We're going to get into that for sure. But it's also a commentary about our changing world, its environment, our dependence on, infatuation with, and worship of technology. Lawrence Millman, welcome to Coast to Coast.
George, I'm delighted to be here.
You know, I don't know how to give a higher compliment than to say this. This book reminded me of John Steinbeck, who's my favorite novelist, favorite writer. He often wrote from the viewpoint of a marine biologist, books like Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday, where he would make observations about nature and talk about these small creatures and weave them into his story, reminding us kind of how they're part of us and we're part of them. And that's what I thought of as I read this book.
I take that as a high compliment, because while I haven't read Steinbeck in recent years, he was my favorite author when I was but a young lad. And the book I would add to your list is his travel book on going into the Sea of Cortez with the doctor, whose name now escapes me. Was it Ricketts? It was a fellow that was mentioned in Tortilla Flat.
Yeah, he was the character the real life guy who inspired the character of Doc in Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday.
Right, right. So I appreciate that compliment enormously, George.
I had to look back at your resume as I'm reading this book because you know an awful lot about moss and mushrooms and tiny little living critters that I think few of us could name. What kind of training did you have in that regard?
Well, it's a complicated question. I wear a number of hats, and even several that you have not named. I've done a lot of ethnographic work in the Arctic. I've collected old stories and myths from the Inuit. I spent 2 years wandering the Arctic, the Eastern Arctic and Greenland, talking to Inuit elders, collecting stories about different aspects of their existence, the sun running after the moon in the sky, and so on. But with respect to the natural world, I ever since I was very young, I kept thinking there must be an alternative to concrete. There must be something different from what I've been being taught in school. Something out there that, in fact, was the natural world. And early on, I discovered a gentleman named Henry David Thoreau. I read Walden when I was about 12. And well, that was a crucial experience. I also had a mother who fondly went out and captured six-foot-long snakes and brought them back to me to study, look at, and feed. So I think of myself as a naturalist, and I think of myself as someone who would rather be out in nature than doing almost anything else, including, as we will later learn, sitting in front of a screen.
You know, the pivotal, the central events of the book, the murders of these nine people, we're going to get into in detail. They happened a long time ago, 1941. So, you know, we've had a lot of murders since then, including some today. But you weave those events into a much larger narrative about technology, the environment, about religion. Did you know that's where you were going to go when you sort of started on this journey?
No, that's where I was going to go. And in fact, after I collected the material, and I needed to talk to people who remembered these murders. And there were a couple of write-ups in popular magazines and even Arctic scholarly manuals. But I think it's very important to be sitting next to a person who might have been around at a time that the story that person tells takes place. And in fact, I'll backtrack a bit. I was a prisoner of war at an academic institution. I got a doctorate, and I was immersed with the written word and classrooms and the four imprisoning walls. And I finally decided this wasn't the life for me. And I went and lived in the west of Ireland, where people survive via the spoken word rather than the written word. And I think that, you know, this has a connection with my book, because in the book I felt that I needed to hear the story of the murders from elders who were alive at the time the murders took place. And when I was in the west of Ireland, I was essentially documenting a dying oral tradition. And without trying to be mercenary and sell any of my other wares, my first book, Our Like, Will Not Be There Again. And that's a title that actually one can use for a number of my books, because I think of them as Jeremiads for lost ways of life. And even the book that we're talking about is in a way like that. This was a lost way of life was the storytelling, which was being replaced by television. And the place in a particular house where the storyteller sat and told his tales became the place where the television itself sat. And when the storyteller told his tales, there was human conversation, but none after the television took over. And I was on an island called Inishbofin in the west of Ireland, when the first television arrived and was positioned in the local bar, and once it was there, there was silent adoration of the screen and no conversation. And one old fellow said to me, he said, the common name now among his friends for that TV is the monster.
Well, let's talk about technology before we get into the events. You know, I often tell people that I'm a Luddite, if not a technophobe, and it's not only, I mean, in part it's because I'm incompetent when it comes to technology and computers, but really it's because I don't want to be connected all the time. I don't want to be reachable. And right. You use that term to describe yourself. But, you know, we're carrying out this interview via radio, so people all over the world are listening, some via computer, some via satellite. We're not anti-technology here, but I think your theme really resonates, certainly with me, and I'm sure with many of our listeners, about technology. So maybe you could just talk about how you weave that into the narrative that we're going to get into.
Well, I mentioned that, you know, I had a hard time writing this book until I had a revelation. That revelation wasn't in the Belcher Islands, nor in my hometown of Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was in a village, Tassilaq, in East Greenland in 2013. A teenage girl was so busy texting that she was unaware of the approach of a polar bear, which was advancing on her with culinary intent. And at the last moment, the very last moment, she saw the bear, screamed, and the bear loped away. And when I heard that story, I had something akin to an epiphany. And that epiphany said that our devotion to screens was affecting our understanding of the world around us. Both, well, not our understanding only, our appreciation of and inhabitation therein. And that gave me a way of distancing myself from the murders we're going to talk about. And it also made me realize that I could not write about the past, the murders that took place 60, then 70, and 74 years. Time was passing, and I still had my notebooks, and they were gathering dust. I couldn't write about the past without writing about the present. You know, and that I had to write not only about what was happening in 1941, but what was happening in the world around me as I was writing about what was happening in 1941. And I saw that world as becoming, well, one word we could use is robotic, a religious devotion to screens. Screens and technology had become a religion no less destructive in their own way than the religion I described.
I don't know if you heard my in the introduction, I mentioned that we posted an article on our screen, on our website, about an increase in world travel promulgated by Instagram. People want to travel and see the world, not necessarily to see the world, but so that they can take selfies, take pictures that they put on social media. And, you know, I see it when you go to a concert and people have their phones. They're not paying attention to the act.
It's very true. And, you know, one of the things I've been documenting are the number of instances where people who are, you know, who see a wild animal like a bear go and stand in front of it and take a selfie with it. And the bear is not appreciative of that. And there have been numerous attacks on people who've just thought of wildlife as something that can be put into a screen. The whole notion of a selfie, I think it should be made illegal.
Well, I like the idea that people are getting out to see the world, because so many Americans in particular that make judgments about the rest of the world, they don't like this or that and have never been there or bothered to go see it for themselves.
Right.
I,
But
I'll
I
tell
think
you
they
what,
should see the world rather than photograph it. And they should see the world rather than photograph themselves in that world. I would recommend not taking a camera or an eye device along when you're going out into the world.
All right. We're talking with Lawrence Millman about his book, At the End of the World. When we come back, we're going to talk about the circumstances that led to 9 murders. Canadian rockers and observers of the human condition, Rush, take us into the break with their song, Subdivisions. Shaken All Over, released in 1965. When this version of the song came out, the group was known as Chad Allen and the Expressions. You know them better as Guess Who, a venerable act from north of the border, still around these days. We're talking with Lawrence Millman about his book, At the End of the World. A story, I'll tell you, tragedy hangs over this like a cloud of mustard gas. And in a moment, we're going to get into the specifics about the events of 1941, the 9 people who died, and what led to those deaths. Stick around. We'll be right back. Lawrence Millman, tell us about the Belcher Islands, this land, what's there, the people, the nature of the environment. I mean, it's harsh, it's hard, it's cold, but prior to, the Western world arriving, those folks had everything they needed. They were essentially happy, didn't know what they were missing.
That's right. And, you know, they, as the crow flies, the Belcher Islands are a lot closer to civilization, such as it is, than a number of other places in the Arctic. But they weren't contacted because they didn't fit into the category of, oh, let's go and get to the North Pole, let's discover the Northwest Passage, or in the case of Canada, Hudson Bay Company, beavers. There were no beaver skins or beavers in the central part of Hudson Bay. So they remained more or less undiscovered until 1916. And while the latitude is not truly Arctic, I think it's probably about the same latitude as Aberdeen, Scotland. The geography, the wind-blasted tundras and rocks, the landscape, and indeed the flora is truly Arctic. And I have to admit, you were mentioning something earlier about sit in front of a fire and put on those long clothes because of that. I happen to be a person who delights in the cold, and wherever possible, I head north. I don't go to the tropics. The whole idea of sitting on a beach and getting embraced by the carcinogenic sun does not appeal to me. What I want to do, you know, I can bundle up and go and enjoy the Arctic, but if it's excruciatingly hot, there are only so many items I can take off. And one of the great virtues of the Arctic is all the diseases that one has in the can get in the tropics, starting with malaria, are unknown up north. You just have one, hypothermia. But as an aside, that was an aside, with the Belchers, this was an Inuit group of people who lived there essentially a hunter-gatherer existence for hundreds of years. Probably they originally came from northern Quebec and migrated down. The islands were rich in seals, walrus, bird life, all the sorts of things one would need to make clothing with and to make food of. And that actually one of the unfortunate aspects of this event that took place in 1941 is that, and I don't think it would have happened if this hadn't been a really ghastly winter with almost no game and the whole population, which at the time was about 170 people, on the brink of starvation. When you're on the brink of starvation, even something truly bizarre, something coming from up in the sky, might seem like it would be worth considering.
You write about their first encounter with the Western world. This documentary filmmaker, essentially the first documentary filmmaker, shows up in 1916. What are the circumstances that brought him there? And describe a bit about what happened. He seemed to have had a pretty good time while he was there.
Who's best known as the filmmaker who made Nanook of the North. And in fact, he was not a filmmaker at the time. He was a mining engineer. Specifically, he was looking for iron ore. And his boat, the Laddie, I mean, there was a history of boats being wrecked in the Belchers. I mean, reefs, rocks, rocks were essentially the geography. He was wrecked there and obliged to overwinter. And he got to know the Inuit, and some of them, especially the women, he got to know quite well. And some of my informants were offspring of Flaherty. Well, they were grandchildren of Robert Flaherty. In any event, he made the Ur version of Nanook of the North there that winter. He filmed these people, and this film was subsequently lost. And he remade it in 1922 on the Quebec mainland. And by that time, he had more or less reconsidered himself as not a mining engineer, but a filmmaker. And the film that he made, I really would dearly have loved to see the one that he made in Belcher Islands, because I have a feeling it would have been a documentary, whereas I think of Nanook of the North as essentially romantic fiction. Some people disagree, but I mean, there's a scene where Nanook is struggling vehemently to get a seal up from a hole in the ice, and when he pulls it out, it's obvious if you look at it that the seal, it has long been dead, that it was put at the end of the line, and he struggled fictionally with it. It was in an advanced state of rigor mortis. And Flaherty, if you read his journals, was not a kind man. There's one journal entry where, you know, he's trying to make the film, and Nanook is lazy, the man who plays Nanook. Nanook means polar bear. There were very few polar bears on the shore of Quebec there, so it may not have been an accurate name. In fact, Nanook was the village postman and had a pretty good sense of the outside world. Anyway, Nanook is smoking his pipe and seemingly at peace with the world, and Flaherty is really annoyed because he wants him to help make a snow house. And instead, Nanook is sitting on the sled, smoking his pipe. And what Flaherty says in his journal is, "I really busted him off today. I knocked him out of the sled, knocked the pipe out of his mouth, and the tobacco out of the pipe. That will teach him." So Flaherty is not a person I am terribly fond of. And if, you know, he's, you know, highly regarded in certain cinematic circles, and he indeed was the first white outsider to visit the Belcher Islands. And I think it's in some ways interesting that that person was a filmmaker. In other words, it connects maybe the Belchers with the screen aspect of my book.
I didn't really know why I knew the name Nanook of the North, but I did, and I don't think I've ever seen the film, but I was surprised to learn that image is what was on Eskimo Pies for so long.
It was on Eskimo Pies, yes, and it actually, and you could say that a number of the sequences in the film are probably derived from what Flaherty saw in the Belcher Islands during his overwintering. rather than on Quebec mainland, which was far more advanced. And the Inuit there had, you know, long, there had been a Hudson Bay Company post there. And although Nanook in the film is seen, you know, he's there's an old gramophone, and he's wondering, how blazes is that sound? Where is that sound coming from? Is there a human being or a speaker or a, indeed a whole chorus lodged inside that? And he's bending over and looking very perplexed. And actually, this image is in the book. But in fact, in real life, he had a record player and new records. They weren't alien artifacts from an extraterrestrial realm.
So it was staged. And as a filmmaker, he takes liberties with the reality.
Yes. It's curious that he's called the father of documentary when, in fact, you know, essentially he created a romantic fiction.
But what he creates generates a lot of interest in these people. I mean, it's I don't know if it's you could call it a sensation, but I mean, a lot of people then are interested in the story of them.
Yes. Well, I know. I know. He also he introduced popcorn to the Belcher Islands, which is and you could argue, you know, that it's very popular today. It was popular in his time. It was called, because of the sound that's made in making the popcorn, it's known as gun food. You know, he made popcorn. He had a popcorn maker on the boat, and he salvaged it and gave it to people, and he remarked in his diary that this was the most surprising thing by way of the of food they had ever seen. And when I was, let's see, it would have been 85 years later, there was still an infatuation with popcorn among the Inuit, and they still called it gun food.
When does religion arrive? Well, maybe the way to describe it is, what was sort of their spiritual beliefs pre-Western intervention, and when did the Western version hit them?
Their spiritual beliefs, I don't even know whether spiritual is the right word. They believed that everything had a soul. You know, a birds, flora, fauna, mushrooms, drift logs had a soul, and so did amak, that's excrement. And one had to respect nature because all of nature had a soul. And of course, one of the things, I'm going to digress briefly to a missionary in Greenland, and Greenlanders had the same belief. And he was furious when he heard that and yelled, "Only man has a soul." And there was this stunned silence. You know, he went on and on and on, then brandished a rifle. And you see, we have rifles. Do your drift logs, do your birds, do your... And it worked, because one uses a rifle to hunt. It's perhaps easier than going out with a harpoon. So, thus, human beings became the only individuals with a soul. But in the Belchers and other remote Inuit areas, there were no sky gods. You know, the gods were part of nature, part of the world around people. And they realized that they had to respect those gods, because if they didn't, they would become very hungry. So, you know, there was a belief that, okay, there was a master of seals who, if they killed too many seals, and it wasn't necessary, that master would tell the other seals, "Hey, don't give yourselves to these people. They are overly consumptive." There was nothing in the sky. There were a few beliefs about, you know, constellations that I collected during my northern wanderings, and a belief about the sun and the moon being brother and sister, and the reason that day follows night is that the sun and the moon are, the moon is actually chasing after the sun because he has a carnal interest in her. He is the male. But apart from things like that, you know, their world was very much a world of nature, and living with nature and understanding nature. And very different from what we would call the Judaic Christian Islamic axis that puts so much of its emphasis up in the sky.
Describe how they were converted.
Well, it was what happened, and you know, it's a story that there are a lot of gaps. There wasn't any historian around in the 1930s to document exactly when a missionary came. Spent maybe a few days at the Belchers, and he left the Bible that was printed in Inuit syllabics. And Reverend Peck in the 19th century believed that the natives of Canada had some relationship to Middle Easterners, and that hieroglyphics and cuneiform alphabets would be the sort of alphabets that they would appreciate and approve of. So the syllabic Bible was left behind, and only one man, a fellow named Kitiwonek, could read it. How he learned to read syllabics, we have no idea. There are a lot of question marks with this story. But he would periodically bring people together in his snow house and read the Bible to them. And, you know, one could imagine the stunned looks on their faces when they heard about a gentleman who got himself impaled on a pair of cross sticks. Actually, they might not have even understood that, because the notion of having sticks and trees and so on would have been alien to them. He read, but there were certain essentials that he repeated over and over again. Namely, that God and Jesus were good guys and Satan was a bad guy. We don't know. We know also that he read from the book of Matthew. There's a passage, I think it's Matthew 24 from the Reverend Peck's Bible, that the stars will fall from the sky and you will see the Son of Man coming. Now, the Son of Man is, in fact, Jesus. And that was a crucial passage. It stuck in the people's minds so that when, in fact, some years later, there was a meteor shower that went on for an extended period of time, it was taken as a very unusual event, indeed, a sign. And it was a sign that said the Son of Man would appear.
So they remember this passage about a sign from the sky. A meteor shower happens in 1941, and it kicks a whole series of things into gear that lead to tragedy.
Yes, and it might not have led to tragedy, but for the fact that this was a terrible winter. Hunting was bad. There were no seals, no Arctic hares, no walrus. The caribou had long since died off in the Belcher Islands in the 1880s. There was hardly anything to eat at all. And when you're hungry and on the verge of starvation, when something bizarre like a meteor shower occurring and a certain individual saying it's a sign, and what it means is I am Jesus, you may be more likely to accept this than if it had occurred on a bright sunny afternoon in downtown Las Vegas, where you can always go into
a buffet.
Any shop or buffet or Dunkin' Donuts. Well, you don't do have those in Las Vegas?
Oh, yeah.
Donuts?
Oh, yeah.
You do. Okay, you can always go there and, you know, whatever you crave, coffee, donuts, whatever. But Las Vegas and the Belcher Islands are two very different places.
We're talking with Lawrence Millman about his book, At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic, and now the table is set. They were introduced to the Bible, and there had been a sort of a prophecy, a meteor shower that kind of rung a bell with the Inuit, who took that, in some cases, sort of too far. And the consequences are what we will discuss on the other side. We're going to take a break now. Gordon Lightfoot, take us into the break, and we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.